It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 13 years ago, Joe McHugh, a writer, musician, and award-winning public radio journalist, began a search to find the family of an African-American woman named Helen, who cared for him when he was a child and who helped his family survive a terrible tragedy. No one remaining in his family, however, knew Helen's last name or where she had moved after leaving his home when Joe was 5. Joe McHugh has chronicled his search in an award-winning Post-Gazette article and a book called Coins in the Ashes. He joins us now in Studio A. Joe McHugh, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, it's always great to come back to Pittsburgh. It's my native city.
Let's begin by having you talk about your family. It was a post-war, post-World War II baby boomer situation where your dad, who was a hero in World War II, started his family in, you said it was in the Aspinwall area, and was working, and it was a typical American, middle-class American family that seemed to be doing quite well until a terrible tragedy befell you. And have you give us a little bit of the background and then tell us about what happened.
Well, this is, in a lot of ways, when I approached this whole quest, and it really what became a quest, was looking at my mother's life and then how she married into this family. My mother came from Paterson, New Jersey, and then Sussex County, New Jersey, which was a kind of a rural area. And her father ran a tavern, and through the hardest days of the Depression, it didn't even start as a tavern. It started as a roadside hamburger stand. You know, where you pull up in a Model A Ford and you couldn't even go inside. You just get your hamburger and your hot dog. So my mother really came up from definitely working class Irish immigrant roots, but she was one of these people that just had this total love affair with books from an early age, and she read voraciously. That resulted in her always graduating the very top of her class, whether it was Little Stanhope Elementary, but then it was Benedictine Academy in Paterson, and the nuns sort of helped her out. So she wound up going to a school called Georgian Court College in New Jersey. And that's where she became very good friends with my father's sister. The McHughes were from Pittsburgh, and they were quite prominent as a family. My grandparents lived on the corner of Devonshire Street and Ellsworth Avenue in Shadyside. And this family had a business. My grandmother's father had started it, you know, proverbial get off the boat from Ireland with $2. I don't think it was exactly that. But he had a woolen business. Now, I only knew it as a woolen business all my life. It was only when I did the research on this book, I found out they had a tannery over on the north side, and they had a woolen mill, you know, spinning mill for the wool. And so they were very well to do. And they had, in fact, the family played a prominent role in establishing the Field Club in Fox Chapel. So my father had survived the war. He was a Silver Star, had been awarded the Silver Star, 3 Bronze Stars, 3 Purple Hearts. He had seen a tremendous amount of action. I think it damaged him in some ways, which I only got later, you know, reading some letters. I never knew him. So he came back from the war. It's kind of a very romantic story because he really had only met my mother once. Came back and immediately proposed to her. So they got married. She moves to Pittsburgh. So she's now living, you know, kind of this much higher social life. And they bought a house just in Fox Chapel, just across from Aspinwall, in a little place called Shady Lane. That was the name of the street. It was about 6 houses on the street. And my brother was born in 1948, late 48. I was born in 1950. And just before I was born, they had hired, I think they had someone before and it didn't work out, but they had found this woman named Helen, who was about 59, 60 years old. So this was a woman who'd had her own family. And they hired her and she was living with us. And so
hired her as help and around the house and doing whatever chores needed to be done?
Exactly. And, you know, really, it was these women did everything. And I'm sure a lot of people listening will have had similar experiences. And a major part of what they did was raise the children, too. But in our case, it even became more important because in 1951, my father, very suddenly, he had flown to Pittsburgh to look at a shipment of sheepskins that they were going to buy. They were great importers from South America, Australia. All these sheepskins were coming into Pittsburgh, and that's what they did. And he came back, and he had the flu, and he just didn't feel really well. And my mother thought it was just the flu, and eventually, they decided he would go to the hospital. My grandmother was one of the pink ladies, I think. And so she was like, well, just go in, you'll get better sleep. And The next day, he was dead from polio, and that's just how it happened. And my mother was pregnant at the time, and she was about 6 months pregnant. And when she delivered my brother, Patrick, he only lived for 48 hours. So the world really, you know, just fell in on the McHughes at that point.
And after your father died suddenly, there was an immense amount of fear in the family that that this virus was alive and that anybody in the family, you, your brother, or your mother, who was with child at the time, that any of you were susceptible to getting the same thing and having the same thing happen that happened to your father that killed him.
Right, and one of the stories is the Freivogel, Tom Freivogel with the Freivogel Funeral Parlor, was my father's best friend. And they got a call in the middle of the night that what was not a flu was, in fact, polio, and they were desperately trying to get an iron lung, and there wasn't an iron lung in the city available. That's how the epidemic, how widespread it was, and the fear.
Well, and your dad was 33, and they called polio, was referred to as the killer of young adults.
Yeah, this was unusual that he would have died as quickly as he did. So Tom Freivogel jumped in. He had an ambulance service, and I kind of love the picture of this, but he drove down to Greensburg in the middle of the night, lights flashing, with a police escort, and brought back the only iron lung they could find, but it was too late. So the fear was absolutely real, and it wasn't until I worked on this project, and you know, I don't know, it certainly speaks to racial or class, you know, sensibilities, because you know, I didn't realize not only was my mother, it was never said that my mother was afraid. I mean, she never said that, but to look at it, you know, your imagination. So, God, they must have been terrified.
And I should correct what I said earlier. I said it was the saying about polio was that it was the crippler of young adults, but obviously it was something that could be deadly.
Oh, and it was a very contagious virus. And so, anyhow, what I want to say is, what about Helen? You know, I mean, that didn't even enter my mind until I was really quite down the road looking for her family, I realized how. How would she thought of this? You know, here's the man of the house that just died. She's got a pregnant woman who's 28 years old. She's 60. Two young children.
Yeah, she could have very easily made the decision that to leave, that it was in her best interest to get out of that house. What do you suppose kept her around?
Well, get, you know, emotional thinking about it. It's when I recorded my mother, and what led to this whole quest to find Helen was I had recorded my mother. I had gotten this grant to do a public radio series on family stories. And this is sort of a precursor or before StoryCorps came along. And it was very specifically looking at family stories. And these are the classic stories we tell at weddings and funerals. You know, they're kind of ritualized, short, usually pithy stories. So I was having a ball. I was traveling around the country, but I needed some practice because I wasn't really up on the digital editing stuff. I got in the grant because I'm a storyteller, but not necessarily a good radio guy at that point. So my mother was living with us, and this is in California, and she'd had a bout of cancer. And so, you know, but I still said, you know, hey, Mom, can I record you? And now she was Irish, and she really went into a long depression when this happened, but she came out of it. It was a great...
Well, this goes back to what Helen did for your family, because after your father died, your mother is 6 months pregnant, the baby is born but does not survive, and then she is despondent, and you had mentioned what a voracious reader she was, and so she ends up just going into her room and closing herself off from the rest of the family and reading, and Helen steps in. Talk about how she holds your family together.
Well, when I recorded my mom and why I was saying that about recording her, one of the things she said in the course of all these stories about the family, and I thought I knew most of her stories because she liked to tell, she loved family stories, and all these new stories came out, which I think is unique, that people, maybe, you know, they're getting close to the end of their lives, begin to kind of tell a different story and focus on different things. But she did tell a story of coming home from that hospital, this is right after my father died, and throwing herself in Helen's arms. That's exactly the word she used, and saying, Helen, please don't leave me now. And Helen said, I won't until you ask me to. And that was really true, because Helen even moved with us 2 years later to New Jersey. But the thing was, after my mother died, we talked about Helen. I had this enormous affection for Helen, but she left when I was five, so I had memories of her. But there was always a sense of somebody very important to me. And she had left, and not much was said. You know, it's just the times. Kids don't, they're supposed to not know these things or something. And so life went on. But after my mother had died, I was doing some work in juvenile justice with some conferences and people like that. And I became aware of a lot of the research being done in brain development in young children because, you know, there were presenters and experts in the field. And this one fellow was talking about something called sad brain syndrome. And, of course, the phrase, turns out it was his own phrase, but it's really accurate. It's the research backs this up, that a child between the time it's in utero until the age of three, if the mother goes into a prolonged state, and this fellow used the word melancholy, the child will mirror the emotional state of the mother in the very physiology of the brain. And that person will have chronic or, you know, prolonged issues with depression for the rest of life because it's how their brain first was shaped. And when I heard this, I was fascinated by the subject. I want to find out how true that was or not. But it was like this light. I mean, I just knew I'm not that person because of Helen.
And when we come back, we're coming up to a break here, but when we come back, I want to talk about what Helen did that spared you the fate of being a child wired for depression, and then your search to find her after she left your family when you were 5 years old. It's an amazing story. We're talking with Joe McHugh, who is the author of Coins in the Ashes. It is the story of his search to find the family of an African-American woman named Helen who cared for him when he was a child and who helped his family survive a terrible tragedy. We'll continue our conversation coming up. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're continuing our discussion with Joe McHugh, who is the author of Coins in the Ashes, a family story of grief, gratitude, and grace. It is the story of his search to find the family of an African-American woman named Helen, who cared for him when he was a child and helped his family survive a terrible tragedy, the death of his father suddenly of polio at the age of 33 in 1950. And we talked about that tragedy and how it impacted his family. And they had a woman, a domestic helper named Helen, who did more than just assist. She stepped in when your mother went into this terrible depression after your father died and she lost a child. And I'm curious, you had said before we went to break that Helen spared you this fate of being a child prone to depression in those very formative years between birth and three, the age of three. What did Helen do? To talk about how she really, in a sense, stepped in and raised you boys, you and your brother, your older brother.
She was there, and it was never hidden in the family. I mean, my mother never, it was kind of well known all my life that my mother really did do this, of going into, as it were, the bedroom and reading her way through that. She was such a reader during the hardest days of the Depression. So this was a mechanism that worked for her.
And I think a lot of us can understand that you would turn to something comforting to get through a tragic episode and the depression that understandably would follow. But at the same time, I'm sure people listening to this are saying, okay, you have two other children that you need to take care of, and you're fortunate enough to have this help, but what if you didn't? Or even if you do, why would you, in a sense, abandon your children? Did you ever resent her for that?
Well, you know, this that idea we have about, you know, supposedly how capable we're supposed to be and things. This is a 28-year-old woman who had really moved into a society that was quite alien to her in many ways. She understood that world because she had read about it. So she knew what it was to be, you know, we were members of the Pittsburgh Athletic Club and the University Club. I mean, this was a different world than the daughter of a tavern owner, basically from northern New Jersey, kind of out in the wilds, as it were. So I think that, you know, when you take it all together, it was just a devastating experience that she did pull through, and pull through, I think, in a marvelous way. But, you know, we're human beings, and I think she did the best she could, and I've always thought that. And I think Helen was there, and that was a great blessing.
And what did Helen do?
Well, you know, Helen did everything. I mean, these were, and this is not unique, these are women who had a room in the house, got one day off a week. You know, they'd go get their hair done or they'd go to church or...
I think the way a lot of us understand this is what we've seen in movies. You know, there's this woman that, for whatever reason, almost seems to just give themselves over to this human instinct of clearly I'm being charged with caring for these children, so I'm going to be all in and care for these children as if they were my own.
And that's the remarkable thing about this. And there is some sort of I interviewed a number of very important scholars in the field of both brain science. And I learned a lot. I mean, and I do a whole chapter in the book about this because I was trying to understand, you know, what does that mean, sad brain syndrome? You know, was this real? And, you know, just getting a concept that there is something called the mind that's not the brain. I used those words interchangeably. And boy, was I quickly, explained to me that that's not how things are. But what happened in, you know, the situation for me was that I just knew instinctively that Helen had played this role. When I heard this guy give this talk, it wasn't like I had to think it out rationally and sort of got mm-hmm. there. I was already there. And I guess that idea of gratitude was already deep in me that I had felt I should do something. Of course,
you remember, though, before we move on to that, what do you remember about what Helen did? She fed you, she bathed you, she sang to you.
Well, the singing to me, absolutely, and I have this memory of her singing. Now, what was interesting, I talked to Dr. Dan Siegel from UCLA, and he was just absolutely wonderful in that he, you know, he's internationally known and has done great work in this field. And he was willing to take the time and kind of look at my story and kind of, you know, analyze it from the point of view of what we understand about relationships. You know, we don't realize that, you know, so you have the brain and then you have the mind. And the third part of this third leg is relationships. And we think the mind is being emanated from the brain. You know, the brain is this physical thing that has chemicals and electricity going through it. And then the mind, what we think of consciousness, is this other thing. But there's evidence now that the mind has the capability through reflection to change the very physiology of the brain. How does that happen? Well, the third element in this dynamic relationship is relationships. And this happens all through our lives. But it is very profoundly obvious in very early childhood. I mean, if you want to see what that three-way kind of thing is going on. So Helen is there, as it turns out, when I found Helen, and that's...
Well, before you even embarked on the search, at what point in your life did you start thinking about Helen again? Because she left when you were five, and presumably you would have gone on to, you know, do the other things that a kid growing up does, and, you know, you're going through school. But something triggered your need to search for her. What was that?
Well, I'd always had this sense of Helen as a very important person. Like when I met my wife, Paula, which coincidentally I met in Pittsburgh this years later, because I did not grow up in Pittsburgh. I was born here. When I met her, she was an artist here. And one of the first things we do on the first date is I'm talking about Helen. I mean, where did this come from? So, and what Dan Siegel talks about is what he calls implicit memory versus explicit memory. So I had this huge amount of implicit memory. There's this thing that happens in children, which I think is just so weird and cool in some way, but it's called second phase childhood amnesia. And basically about age 5 or 6, we just get wiped clean. The hard drive gets cleaned out. It's just like, you do remember things earlier up to that age, and then suddenly you don't remember hardly anything. Few isolated things. I have an isolated memory, a very specific memory, because there's a lot of emotion to it, where I came home, and I get kind of emotional telling this, and I wrote about it in the book, is I came home from school one day. This is after we moved to New Jersey. I was in kindergarten, and I sat at the table with Helen, who I just thought the world of. You know, and so I said, are you a neighbor? And she looked at me and just did not respond, and her eyes filled up with tears, and she got up and left the room, and I just felt terrible. I don't know what I'd done, but I'd done something. And sorry.
It's okay. You're obviously very emotional as you're recalling this story.
Well, my mother later, you know, I mentioned to her, and I'm sure what was happening is I just heard it in school, you know, and I didn't know that was, you know, a name I shouldn't use. And my mother said, oh, you know, never use that. It's very insulting. And so this sense of...
Were you recalling this later? Did you think, you know,
I've always had this memory. I've
got to find her. The thing that...
No, because, you know, I figured she was long gone. And she was. I mean, she died in 1960, I found out. So I didn't know, you know, and we can talk about how I wound up finding her.
This is what I want to get to, because I don't want to run out of time before we get to this. So you had to find her, and there were any number of reasons why you would want to, clearly. So when did the search begin, and how long did it take you?
Well, what happened right after that, I heard about the sad brain syndrome. That's when I decided that I had to find her family, because I knew, again, she would have passed away, just given her age. And that's why I never thought of it until that point. But suddenly I felt this requirement to thank her family. And I didn't know who they were going to be. I mean, I could show up at their door in some place and they'd just look at me like, you know, what are you doing here? You know, we don't need to hear this. But I had to do it. And so I called everybody in the family. My mother had died and had passed away. And nobody knew Helen's last name, which is typical of the time. It was Helen. I talked to my father's a sister who was still alive, the only one of that generation still alive. And she said, oh, no, it's just Helen. We had Lucille, and she knew Lucille's last name that worked for them. We gave her a pension and this and that. But no, it was just Helen. I don't know. I said, well, did you get her through a service? Could I find? Oh, no, no. This was all done informally. In fact, there was a lot of rivalry between families. Some families wouldn't talk to each other because somebody stole their servant. It was really hard to get good help after the war. And all the families had help. This is not an isolated story. So at that point, nobody knew. I called cousins that knew her as little kids. Nobody knew. So that was it. My brother didn't know. But they all told me she did not live in Pittsburgh. So, you know, that's even better help. So 3 years goes by, and I got this cousin. I love him to death. But he's a guy who calls you up at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, maybe he's had a drink or two. He's not alcoholic. It's just, you know, he gets reminiscing. And he always liked me. I was this hippie, went off and bought a farm in West Virginia. So I'm not like the rest of the family, you know. And he kind of fights with everybody. And it's just an Irish thing. But I'm like the hippie. So he calls me up. Hey, Joey, how are you? You know, I'm like, oh, Chris, you know, great. How are you? And then he's talking to me. And suddenly he says, you know, I found these letters that your mother sent to my mother. They were just the two sisters, the two daughters. And he says, are you interested in looking at these letters? It turns out there was one letter, and there was only about a dozen of these letters that had a reference that my mother said, last Sunday, Helen heard that her grandson died in a house fire in Maryland. He had a one-year-old child. He was 19, and she's down there now, and will be back in a week. No last name, no place in Maryland, no specific place. But I knew, Paul, I don't know how to explain this.
But this got you you closer.
I knew I'd find her. You know, I called the state archive, and they said, no, you don't have enough information, but there might be a newspaper article about a house fire. But these, were people who worked, and it turns out to be true because I found the family, all worked in domestic work, worked as laborers mostly. These were not significant people in terms of the news world. But through a quirk, an absolute miraculous quirk of a whole bunch of fires that occurred on a certain weekend in Maryland, this story got included in this really crazy way. And it ultimately, through the Library of Congress and the research I did, I found the family.
And what happened when you contacted them?
Oh, this is a whole. I mean, when I eventually get to, it's Brunswick, Maryland, right on the border of, it's on the Potomac River. And, I mean, it was really a knockout. I found an article about a fire where a 20-year-old died, and it didn't say he was Negro or colored, which is how they would write it back then. So I didn't even know if I was on the right track. It was the only possible fire story, as it turns out, that could have been it. And my mother said 19. So I get up there, and I get up to Brunswick late in the day, and I start talking to the guys at the fire department, which is right downtown, kind of unusual. And then they send me over to talk to somebody in the ambulance service, and they call somebody else, and no, nobody knows about a fire in 1952 in Brunswick. That's where it happened, this fire. But there is there were very few African-American people living in this community. Called me up. So she said, well, call this one woman named Estella Bell. She's 80 years old, and she volunteers at the local museum, and she knows everybody if there's anybody. So I called her up, and I talked to her, and told her all about what I was looking for. Didn't know. I didn't think I was even close. And when I was done, she said, oh, you're looking for Helen, Miss Helen, she said. And I said, yeah, that's my mother-in-law. When you went off to New Jersey, I worked for your grandparents on Devonshire Street. And you could have knocked me over with a feather. So I found the family.
And what was it like to be reunited with them?
they welcomed me as if they had known me all my life and, you know, really had. It wasn't like I was a stranger. In fact, I asked for photographs. I had one photograph of Helen that was in my baby book. That's all I had ever had to go with. Estella pulled out three photographs. That's all she had of Helen. And one showed Helen in one of those booths where you drop a quarter in. It's what we used on the front of the book. It's a great picture. The other, Helen sitting, looking tired by a dresser that's in my dining room. The third picture had my grandfather, my mother's father, my uncle, and Helen handing my uncle a cigarette. And I'm sitting on my grandfather's lap looking out of the picture. And I've been in that house in Brunswick for almost 58 years.
What an amazing story.
Yeah.
It's all chronicled in Coins in the Ashes, a family story of grief, gratitude, and grace. And Joe's going to be telling stories all around Pittsburgh this weekend. Joe McHugh, the author of the book. Joe, we're just about out of time. Just give me one date that you're going to be doing.
Okay. Homewood tonight, Homewood Library at 7, 2 o'clock at the Squirrel Hill Library, 10 a.m. tomorrow morning at the Downtown Library, and then 2 p.m. on Sunday at Fox Chapel.
Again, our guest has been Joe McHugh. He's the author of Coins in the Ashes, a family story of grief, gratitude, and grace. Joe, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story with us.
Oh, absolute pleasure, Paul.
Coming up, from radio-controlled vehicles to 3D-printed toys, the Maker Faire is coming to Pittsburgh. We'll have a preview with its creator, Dale Daugherty. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.